Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
And Adam Maguire is here now from the RTE Business Desk, and Adam's going to talk to us about the ingredients lists on food products, what the rules are, how to understand them, and why you should be careful around some products which say that they're low in fat because, in fact, they can still contain very large amounts of ingredients like sugar. Good morning, Adam.
How are you?
Good to have you with us. Now, we only glance at them at best, probably, a lot of the time, but there's a lot of rules around what has to be on that label, right?
Yeah, and like that, I'd glance at it and you kind of maybe take it at face value, if even if you're looking at it, but you kind of have to ask, does this have to be here? How, you know, accurate is it and so on? But there are a lot of rules behind it. Some of them set out in European legislation, some in Irish legislation, and it can get very specific. So it basically covers anything pre-packed. There are a few exceptions over things made in small quantities, maybe if they're supplying a local shop. And that set out the definition of those things, small quantities and local, also set out in law. But aside from those cases, any company making a food or drink that's going to be stocked in a shop has to tell you what's inside. So they have to have the list of ingredients, the quantity of the food that's in the packet, the best before or the use-by date, and whether it needs to be stored in any particular way. You also need to give instructions on how to make the thing if they're deemed to be necessary. You need to have the name of the business on there, the origin of the product, if not having the origin could be deceiving in some way to the customer, or if it's required under specific legislation, certain types of food and drink have to have the country of origin on there or the location. And producers also need to detail the nutritional content as well, which people would be familiar with.
Okay, and we'll come to that in a second, the nutritional content, but there are really specific rules, aren't there, around how you list the ingredients, the order that they go in?
Yeah, exactly. So the ingredients are supposed to be listed in descending order, so that the main ingredient should be first, then whatever's second is the next biggest ingredient, and so on down the list. So if you see something that had sugar at the top of the list, you know it's going to be very, very sweet. You know, you might see something then at the end of a list of 20 or 30 ingredients, there's probably only a fraction of a gram per 100 grams in there. Producers also obliged to specifically outline the percentage of certain ingredients in there, what's called quantitative ingredient declarations. Essentially, that applies, you know, when a particular ingredient is highlighted in the name. So, for example, if you buy a cheese pizza, it should tell you the percentage of that product that's cheese.
Because it's saying only 3% cheese.
Yes, like exactly. Yeah. Because they don't want you saying, oh, this is a beef, you know, lasagna, and there's only a tiny amount of beef in there. You need to specify that there is a certain amount in there. If it's a key ingredient or product that might vary from one brand to the other, you have to be specific too. So the Food Safety Authority of Ireland gives an example of marzipan. You need to say the percentage of almond that's in there, because then you can look at one and the other and say, this has more sugar, this has more almond in it. Almonds are also another one that's interesting. It needs to be detailed for a different reason, because you also have to mark out certain allergens, which people might have noticed this, that there are 14 allergens under European law that have to be declared. So wheat, eggs, fish, peanuts, milk, celery, soybeans, different types of nuts, a few other crustaceans and things like that. They have to be highlighted on the list. So a lot of companies will put it in bold, or it can be in a different colour or a bigger font, but it has to stand out on the ingredients list so it's clear that there's an allergen in the ingredients as well. And more generally, there are also rules around how visible the ingredients lists are. They have to be a certain minimum font size and in a clear part of the label, because you don't want them.
I kinda often can't see them.
Yeah, well,
that's more down to me though. Maybe
it depends
size
on the size of the label. It can change, but I suppose they want to make sure they're not having tiny ingredients lists that nobody could possibly read, as a way of kind of hiding what's in the.
So
product.
There's rules around that as well,
yeah,
around
yeah,
the size.
It has
of the
to be
font.
Somewhat visible.
So do they have to tell us about the calories?
Yeah, they do. They have to outline the energy value of a product in kilojoules and kilocalories, or calories, as most people would just call them. They have to also detail the fat, saturates, carbs, sugars, proteins and salt. And if they want, they can then also outline some other nutritional information like starch, or you'd often see fibre and monosaturates and so on. And all of that has to be detailed per 100 ml or per 100 gram, depending on whether it's food or drink. And if possible, they should also lay it out in a clear table. If the space is tight on a label, they can do it in a list, but ideally they'll have that kind of grid that you'd see on a lot of products. And having the list on a per 100 gram or 100 ml basis, it can actually be a bit confusing in a way, because if the product you're looking at weighs 40 grams or 180 grams, you might look at the thing and get a the wrong impression in terms of the amount of calories or protein or sugar, or you have to do a bit of mental arithmetic to kind of figure it out. But I suppose what it does is it sets a standard, so it's easy then to compare two different products. So they both have per 100 gram. You can immediately see this has more sugar, this has more protein, and you can kind of make a comparison that way. And of course, producers are allowed to list per portion calories alongside the per 100 grams. In fact, some will put the nutrition label on the front of the package, and they've a bit more freedom with that one because that's optional. They're allowed to just list the calories. They can list it per portion if they want. It doesn't have to be per 100 gram. And of course, this is how you can get tricked in different ways, because you have a chocolate bar that says 80 odd calories per portion, but per portion is 2 squares out of 8 or 10 squares.
Same sometimes with cereal as well.
Yeah,
the portion size that they think we're going to have is...
Yeah, I also find one I find particularly tricky is there's a particular brand of cola that has a 500ml bottle, and it suggests that the calories per portion is 250ml a portion.
So it's a sharing bottle.
As if you're going to share a 500ml bottle with somebody or split it up over, you know, 2 meals in the day or whatever. But yeah, that's one way you can get kind of tricked by the per portion label.
Now, the companies then, when they're working that out, the calories in a product, how do they do it?
Yeah, there's a number of ways to do it. It's not necessarily easy. They can sit down and look at the calories on the ingredients they use. They can look at the quantities that go into their product, multiply and divide from there, and work out basically what goes into each product. And that would probably be the way a small producer would probably do it, because it's probably the most cost effective way. Same goes for nutritional information. They can work that out as well. There are more scientific options if they want. They can send it to a lab to be analysed. And there are companies out there that consult on nutrition and food safety that would do this kind of work for you. And it's actually a pretty interesting process. So I was looking at a video to get the calories. You basically get the product, you put it in a blender until it's homogenized, so it's just mush. You then dehydrate it, so you turn it into a powder, put it into a little pellet, and then you put it into a machine called a bomb calorimeter or calorimeter. And essentially that blows it up, that sets it on fire, and it measures the amount of heat that comes off that little pellet, which tells you the amount of energy that's in there.
That's
and from there, you then multiply and divide up to get what the proportion is.
I bet
is.
You loved watching that video.
I did actually really enjoy watching the video. Yeah, they did it with like a Christmas dinner, and it was interesting seeing it turned into mush and then into powder, and yeah, to think that that's how they deal with the food. There are other than different kind of scientific tests depending on what you're looking for in terms of, you can do what's called a Jumis method to calculate protein. You can use an ion meter to measure salt, a refractometer or filtration method to measure sugar. So you can do all these scientific tests, although I'd say a lot the smaller companies will just sit down and do the sums themselves to work it out.
Because, that, I mean, all of those methods sound quite expensive.
Yeah, they can be, yeah. And as I said, if you're a small producer, it's going to cost you a lot. Obviously, if you're a massive, big manufacturer and you're doing this on a huge scale, it's probably relatively small. But the important thing is that they have to be confident in the figures, because the producer is the one that has to stand over the claims. Even if they get someone else to calculate it for them, they're the ones that are putting it on their label. They're responsible for it. And making a mistake can be expensive as well. Or say if the rules around labeling were to change, but they tend not to, they tend to stay the same, but it would be a big undertaking for the business, because not only would you have to spend the time and money reworking all the nutritional values, you'd also have to redesign the labels, maybe across multiple products. You have to then roll them out with your distributors. You maybe have to pull back the old stock that has the old labeling on it and possibly destroy that, which is a waste. One expert in Board B suggested to me it could take anywhere between 6 and 18 months between actually starting the design process and getting the products on the shelves for a company to change their labelling. So it's a long process and an expensive process, and something they could be spending their time doing something else as well. And of course, if a company is found to be misleading people or mislabelling their products, there are potential fines. And the Food Safety Authority of Ireland does monitor the market for any potential bad practice. In the past, it's also carried out specific reports trying to work out the accuracy of nutritional labelling, the accuracy of allergen that's on packaging, which is obviously very important for anyone who has an allergy out there. That it's reliable.
Their homework is checked then.
So
they need to be pretty accurate.
There's a certain kind of leeway given it. You don't have to be pinpoint accurate, because it'd actually be impossible to be, because even in a mass production context, the products going in aren't going to be the exact same down to the milligram. The ingredients might be slightly different, and the nutritional content of an ingredient can change from one producer to another. Or for example, even with a natural thing like a fruit, the calorie content and the nutrition can change over the course of the season. And even farmers would tell you that, you know, the protein in milk can change on a cow by cow, day by day basis. So it's impossible to say there's exactly this much in milk and so on. So there is, under the EU legislation, there's a certain amount of tolerance built in that gives you wiggle room. And it's actually a little bit more than I expected it to be honest, because it depends on the nutrient. It depends on the exact percentage of the nutrient in the product. But for example, if a product has anywhere between 10 and 40 grams of sugar in it, there's a 20% plus or minus tolerance.
20%?
20%,
yeah.
So in theory, if a label says it has 40 grams of sugar in it per 100 grams, it could actually have 32 grams or it could have 48 grams. So that's a 16 gram swing per 100 grams, which is relatively big. And that applies to fat, protein, carbs and so on as well, that level of tolerance. For salt and sodium, it's a bit different. It's still 20%, but it's anything over 1.25 grams. And of course, 20% of 1.25 grams is a much smaller amount. But, you know, if something says it has 40 grams of salt, it could have 48 grams of salt, but you probably shouldn't eat it.
So does that mean we have to be particularly careful when something is claiming to be low fat or high protein?
Well, there are other rules then around those claims in particular. And again, it comes down to the amount per gram. So, for example, to say you're low fat under European law, you have to have no more than 3 grams of fat per 100 grams or 1.5 grams per 100 mils if it's liquid. But of course, and as you mentioned, what's often skipped over, even if you do meet that threshold of low fat, is that when something is low fat, they often replace that with sugars or sweeteners, because when you take the fat out, you take a lot of the flavour out as well. So you might, you know, in theory be low fat, but it's not necessarily low calorie or healthy in any way. And the same thing happens with things like protein as well. And there was a big boom a couple of years ago of products adding protein to say that they were high protein. To say you have, you are a source of protein, you have to have 12% of the energy coming from protein. To say you're high protein, you have to have 20% of the energy coming from protein. Again, though, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's low calorie or low sugar or low carb.
That.
You have to watch for all the other things as well. And just, again, fibre is another one that brands will often use as well. To say you're high fibre, you have to have at least 6 grams of fibre per 100 grams, which isn't an awful lot, to be honest. But that's the threshold to under European law to say that you're high fibre.
So buyer beware.
Exactly.
All around.
Scrutinise the label. And even then, you have to allow a little bit of wiggle room in there.
Adam, thank you very much. Adam McGuire, RTÉ business journalist there. Now, you have heard me speaking to Piers Doherty a little earlier about this decision the government has made to opt into the EU's Asylum and Migration Pact. So what will change? Well, we'll speak to immigration lawyer Cathal Malone in a couple of moments.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTÉ Radio 1.